book session number 12811, Reel 2.
Mr. Cannon, Reel 2.
On the 2nd of September, that was 1939, we left Plymouth with an escort of 4 I boats. HMS Inglefield was the flotilla leader. We'd been told that there was a possibility of war. I mean, rumour was going around that it was imminent, the war. And the thing about Courageous was that a big percentage of her ship's company were reservists. They'd been called up again because of the crisis and because of the possibility that war was going to be, you know, was going to break out fairly soon. And we always remember them. When we joined the Courageous, they were joining it more or less at the same time. And most of them were a fairly happy, cheerful, chattering lot. To them, being called up again, they assumed that they were going back to sea for a short time. And that it was only going to be for a short period before they returned home. Unfortunately, for a lot of them, they were never going to come home. Because for them, it was going to be a watery grave in the Atlantic. But nobody suspected this when we sailed from Plymouth. We felt fairly confident. And then the following day, this was on September the 3rd, we were told that there was going to be an important broadcast in the morning. And we should listen to it, you know, from the at the speakers. And I always remember I made my way for it to the boys' mess deck with the other boys. We were all clustered around the tannoy, and it clicked on, and we heard Neville Chamberlain's voice telling us that from 11 o'clock that morning that we were at war with Germany. I wasn't particularly concerned about it, you know. I mean, the brashness of youth and the background of a fairly disciplined training, I had no qualms about going to war. I had no fears about going to war, not at that time. I would have been if I had known that in 2 weeks' time, from that message being broadcast, that I would have been a survivor from the first British warship sunk by enemy action. We were patrolling. First of all, our first duties were covering the routes to France for the expeditionary forces. We were part of the Home Fleet, giving protection. But later, with our destroyer escort, we were on submarine search and destroy, you know, patrols. This was when war broke out. Nothing untoward. We were patrolling up the southwest of Ireland. But on the 17th, that was Sunday, the 17th of September, in the afternoon, we got a signal to say that a merchant ship was being attacked by a U-boat. And our screen were two destroyers port side, two destroyers starboard side. And the captain, McKeg Jones, he ordered two of the destroyers to break formation and go and investigate, you see. Anyway, we watched them go and we thought, well, sleek, you know, they keel well over and they took off at speed. As you know, they were called the Greyhounds of the sea by the Navy. And they'd been gone quite some time as evening started to approach. The planes were out on patrol ahead of the ship. They were searching. And from what I found out afterwards, at 6 o'clock that evening, U-29, that was Lieutenant Otto Schurhart, the German captain, he spotted the Courageous with her two destroyers. This was 6 o'clock. And he stalked it. He was at the end of his patrol at the time, and he was about to abort his patrol. And he spotted this, and he couldn't believe it himself, apparently. Anyway, nobody seemed concerned that we only had a half of our escort with us. And everybody was going about their normal duties, quite unconcerned. But as the light started to fade, which is always a very, very tricky time for ships at sea, because the fading light, it plays tricks with, you know, with lookouts. And I always remember somebody asking me what the time was. And I remember looking at my watch. And I said, it's 4 minutes to eight. I had a reliable watch. I said, it's 4 minutes to eight. And just as I said it, there was a first bang. And I got knocked right off my feet. Wonder what it could be. As I got to my feet, thinking, you know, what the heck's going on? There was a second bang, and it was a second torpedo hitting home. And the lights went out. Within a matter of minutes, she started to list badly to port. And the noise of everything moving from one side to the other was deafening. The whole, anything that wasn't secured down, including some of the planes that had come in that were in the hangar, they were sliding right over to one side, which was making the list all that much more acute. Anyway, I could hear people shouting. I was dark, and I made my way, because in an aircraft carrier, you know, there's long, long passages, and it's like a labyrinth of passages and compartments below decks. I made my way along, and I made my way to the upper deck. I thought, I didn't know what to expect. I could hear men screaming. I could hear other people shouting. And I didn't know what it was, and I thought, good grief. I made my way to the upper deck, and I got the shock of my life, because people were already jumping into the water. Now, we didn't have an issue of life belts at that particular time. The life belts that were on the ship, there was life belts on the ship, but they were the old cork type life belts, and they were stored in tin metal lockers around the ship. But they hadn't been individually issued to ship's company. And of all the drills that we carried out on the Courageous, we carried out every type of drill. We'd never done abandoned ship stations. Nobody ever anticipated we were ever going to be abandoning ship. So consequently, nobody had life belts. And I said to somebody on the upper deck, what's going on? He said, oh, the abandoned ship's been sounded. Well, it was obvious to me that some orders had been given, because men were already jumping into the water. Only one boat that I can remember, and only one Carly float, got away for 1,200 men. And the reason for this was that when the ship was in Plymouth, when she was being refitted, the dockyard people had painted over the Carly floats without taking them off the ship's side. And the ropes were painted. Consequently, when the paint dried, they were stuck to the ship's side. Now, there was, if you ever see a picture of the Courageous, you'll see the Carly floats all the way along. But we couldn't release them. Nobody could release the Carly floats. Well, it was only a token amount of life-saving equipment for the number of people who were jumping into the water. Everybody was hoping that they'd find a piece of wreckage. And when they told me it was abandoned ship, I thought, well, this is it. So I stripped down to my underpants. I thought this was a thing to do, get rid of clothes. Stripped down to my underpants, and it was very, very cold at the time. And I waited for a minute. I picked a spot where there wasn't men, because there was loads of men all plopping into the water. I picked my spot. I took a deep breath, I can remember to this day, and I dived in to the Atlantic. And I'd also been told that when ships go down, there's a certain suction. I don't believe it now, but in those, this was the type of thing you were told as a youngster. So I struck out as far as I could away from the Courageous. After I thought I'd got as far away as I could from her, I turned over my back and I watched her. She just settled down into the water and the sea just closed over her just like a shroud. And then there was a stillness, absolute stillness. The whole area was covered with bobbing heads. The two destroyers that were our escort, they couldn't pick us up. They were whizzing around the outskirts. They knew the submarine was still there. She was still there. They couldn't depth charge in close vicinity without killing an awful lot of us. And they couldn't stop to pick us up because they would have been a sitting target for the U-boat. Consequently, they couldn't come to our rescue. They had to stay well outside of the area where all the men were. And that was getting larger and larger. It's because the ship was moving and men had jumped into the water. They'd spanned out over a fairly wide area. A strange thing was that during the day, that day, we'd passed a little tramp steamer called the Dido. And when we went past her, this flotilla of aircraft carrier and two destroyers, the captain told us after he saw this powerful unit, and he was more or less on a parallel course. So he raised a bit more steam and he thought, well, if we were in that area, it was it was security for himself, you see. So he followed our course as closely as he possibly could, thinking that it was a safe passage if there was that strong unit of the Navy in that area. And a pretty good job he did and all. After I'd been swimming for about an hour and a half, I was looking around. I couldn't find wreckage anywhere. And I was swimming and I was beginning to feel tired, very, very weary. The sea was rough. I had no lifebelt. I had nothing to hang on to. I was turning on my back periodically and just treading water. And I was swimming for a little while because, first of all, I tried floating, but with the waves coming over me, they were choking me. And I found it was better to turn in and actually swim into the waves, And as you swim into them, they lift them up to the crest of a wave and you could breathe. And I found this a far easier way to deal with it than try to float or to, you know, paddle. I was in the water about 2 hours, actually swimming. But after about an hour and a quarter, I felt that I was losing consciousness. And stuff was just fading away from me. Strange enough, I didn't feel frightened. I just felt that I didn't want to do anything. I think it was tiredness because my arms and my legs, they felt like lead weights. And I tell you now, I felt every one of my 16 years that night. And it must have been at one of these periods that there was an observer, a lieutenant observer, who later I recognised, who was swimming close by, and he must have seen that I was just about at the enemy tether. And I remember him shouting to me, and he said, "Come on, lad, come on. Your mum and your dad will be waiting for you at home. Come on, keep trying, son. Come on, keep going." And he kept shouting at me and shouting at me. And it just revived me enough to get going again, and I carried on swimming. And then in the gloom, we realised that this little tramp steamer, the Dido, had eventually come on the scene. He couldn't come right in amongst the survivors. He had to stay out on the periphery. But he was very, very courageous because he must have also known that that U-boat was still there, but he stopped his engines and he started to pick people up. Anybody who could swim to him, he was picking them up. This lieutenant kept shouting at me to keep swimming, and I kept swimming. And eventually, I was pretty exhausted, and I made this rope ladder at the side of the Dido, the little tramp steamer, and I couldn't climb. I was too tired, I was too exhausted, I couldn't get up that ladder. And one of the seamen must have realised the state I was in, and he came down and he grabbed hold of me, helped me up, and eventually got me, bundled me into the deck. By God, I was thankful. Then I made my way into one of the little cabins on the Dido, and there was another group in there, all huddled round, trying to keep warm, all in their underpants, much the same, trying to keep warm, teeth chattering. The crew had enough on their plate trying to rescue people that they would that they'd get out of the water. Eventually, it was really dark, and the Dido had to abort the rescue. We were told then that the Inglefield, a destroyer, which we found later was the Inglefield, would come alongside at night to take off the survivors, but we had to be very quick in the transfer because the U-boat was still there. She hadn't been sunk. Reports said after in the newspapers that she'd been blown out of the water. Well, of course she wasn't. The U-29 and the captain, he survived the war, and he died only about 4 years ago. So the reports in the paper that she'd blown out, it must have been at that moment in time, somebody reported the wrong information. She wasn't. We never got the U-boat. When the destroyer came alongside, we transferred as quickly as possible. We had one lad who they were operating on as best they could in the Dido, and he had his foot ripped off. How he had managed to make the Dido, I don't know. But he was the only actual casualty, and I think he stayed with the Dido because I don't remember him coming aboard the Inglefield with us, and they've been trying to do a patch-up job for him. We transferred to the Dido. Transferred to the Inglefield. And as soon as they got us on board and they got underway, they started to clean us up. The first priority was to clean as much of the fuel oil as possible away from our eyes, you know, from around our eyes and our mouth, and then take it off the body. And then they told us to muster because we were going to be issued with rum. And we got in the line, they gave us a mug, we all got in the wrong, and they broke out neat rum. And when I got to the head of the queue, I always remember the quartermaster was there giving an over-generous helping to everybody, you know, because we were in a pretty horrible state. One of the first things we did when we got on board the Inglefield was to discard our oil-soaked underpants. And a lot of the crew had given us their blankets to put round us. Anyway, when I got to the top of the queue, I always remember a moment of innocence. I said to the quartermaster, I don't draw, which means that I'm too young to be issued with spirits, you see, because I was only 16. I said, I don't draw. And typical of a quartermaster, he said, get that bloody stuff down you, he said, and then hold your mug up and get another bloody lot down you. Well, I was only too grateful. I drank this neat rum, give me another dollop, and I drank that, you know. Then I went and sat in the mess with all the others there, blankets around us, loads of, the boys on the Inglefield, they got loads of hot tea going. And with that and the rum, I fell fast asleep. It must have been in the early hours of the morning. We all woke up with a terrific shock. And we all started to make our way to the upper deck. And what had happened, the Inglefield, she'd remained on the scene, and the other boats had made for home. But the Inglefield had stayed at the scene, hoping to do another trawl the following morning in daylight to see if there was any more survivors. And in the night, they were continually probing for the submarine, and they must have had a positive. And she fired a full pattern of depth charges. And it felt as if she was breaking her back. And of course, the noise, and after what we'd been through, we all woke up in a bit of a panic, you know, and started to make for the upper deck. We thought we were being hit again, you know, but we weren't. When dawn came, we had these blankets, just blanket around us, you know, just to cover our nakedness, because we were naked underneath. And we all made our way up onto the upper deck. And it was a scene of desolation, as far as you could see. All the flotsam and jetsam that would have saved possibly hundreds of lives the night before if it had surfaced in time. It just seemed to cover as far as you could see, but not a single living soul. And the captain went round and round, and in the end he realised that it was fruitless. And he called a search off, and he made for Plymouth. As we were making for Plymouth, another destroyer came upon the horizon, and it was the Kelly, Louis Mountbatten. And I was close by the bridge at the time, trying to keep warm, and I heard the yeoman say to the captain, the Kelly must have signalled him, to the captain of the Inglefield, because he was a full captain, he was Captain D, you see, on the Inglefield. And he said, what did he say? And the yeoman said, he said, can you keep up with me? And the captain said something about, you bloody well tell him I'll see him inside Plymouth Breakwater. And one of the two explicits, which I won't tell you. I don't think Mountbatten was too popular with some of the older captains in the Navy at the time. Anyway, it did us a power of good, because these two set off like a couple of racehorses. Who was going to get into Plymouth first? And it was neck and neck, although she was a brand new destroyer at the time, Kelly. She was pretty new, and the Inglefield had got a lot of sea time under her. We made Plymouth with little no difference. When we tied up in Plymouth, we realised at the time that we must be the last lot of survivors to come in, because the destroyer had stayed behind. We gave our blankets back to the crew of the Inglefield, because they'd been decent enough to give them to us, but we couldn't take their blankets off them. And in return, they gave us little pieces of cloth just to put over our private parts, because we had to walk from the dock up to the barracks. There we were going to be kitted out, you see, hopefully. The Navy, previous survivors had got in there, apparently, they'd sent blankets down. But when we got in, there must have been a hiccup somewhere, because all that came down was a lorry with plimsolls, pairs tied together, so we wouldn't have to walk in our bare feet. So we found a pair of plimsolls that fitted, and we had this piece of cloth which had to put over our private part, and then we had to walk through the dock up to the naval barracks. The thing about it is, a lot of the dockyard people had all turned out to see the survivors come in, because it was quite a big thing at the time, the Courageous being sunk. It was the first warship sunk to turn out. But amongst the people that turned out was a lot of women folk who were obviously working in the dockyard, in the canteens or somewhere, the women who worked in the barracks. And they had also turned out, and it was very, very embarrassing. I always remember, I kept my eyes down on the ground, and I kept my piece of cloth over, and I was keeping my head down. I was going like hell up. And they were lying both sides of the road. And I heard one woman shout, don't you bother none, son, she said. You're home and you're safe, and that's all that matters. Don't take no notice. And after that, I didn't mind. We made our way up to the barracks, and they got everything prepared. Survivors had already come in, so they'd already got things underway. And when we came in, it was very, very smooth. They cleaned the last of the oil off us, hot showers, lots of soap. They got kit ready. There was a hot meal got ready for us. And then we just gave some basic, answered some basic questions, number, rank, and so on and so forth. And then we were issued with money and a rail pass. And it was obvious at the time that the authorities wanted to get us as home as quickly as possible. Looking back with hindsight, I think that the contingency plans, that they were absolutely perfect. There was nothing wrong with the contingency plans for such an emergency. And they contrasted very, very drastically with the treatment that I received later when I was a survivor from the Courageous, which I'll tell you about later.
Survivor from the Dorsetshire.
Sorry.
That's right.
Yeah. When I was a survivor from the Dorsetshire later in 1942, but I'll tell you about that when I come to it. After our survivors leave, as I'm coming out of the depot, at the barracks, people locally must have heard that there was another batch of survivors to come in, and there was crowds all milling around. A lot of women had come down knowing, I think, that if their husbands or their sons weren't with our lot, they weren't coming home. And they were all... I came out with two other boys. And they were shouting names at us. Have we seen so-and-so and so-and-so? And, you know, I'd love to have said, oh, yes, he's with us. You know, the pain and the anguish on their faces, it was tragic. But I couldn't. None of the names that they shout out, I couldn't remember. And as I came out, the quartermaster, who used to give me instruction on the wheel, because as captain's messenger, I still had to be trained as well, and I had a lot of instruction on the wheel. And the quartermaster used to take me for instruction on the wheel. He had lived locally, and he'd come down to see. He'd been a survivor, but he'd come down to see who was amongst the last batch of survivors. And when he saw me, he pushed through the crowd and he grabs hold of me by the hand and he's shaking me. I said, hey, I wonder what had happened to you, lad. I wonder what happened to you. And he's shaking my hand. And just at that moment in time, the newsreel cameras were recording it. And the cameraman said, excuse me, could you just do that again, shaking hands, he says, for the cameras? So we said, yes, all right. So we did a handshake again, just for the camera. Anyway, when I got home, I was on survivor's leave. The local people here were coming around to my mother and they were saying, your boy's on the pictures. Have you seen him on the electric cinema in Torquay? It's not there now, but the old electric cinema. Your boy's on the pictures. And apparently it was on the cinema newsreel, which my mum and dad thought, you know, they thought this was great, you know, that their lad had survived one of the first great episodes of the war, I suppose, as far as we were concerned. And after my survivor's leave, I went back to the Drake, the barracks itself. And then 2 days later, we were transferred to what they called Drake One, which was a rundown holiday camp at Weymouth, at Wembury, just outside of Plymouth. Wembury. It's near Haybrook. And it was a bit of a shock to us when we got there, because we were all trained youngsters. We were trained in gunnery and seamanship and so on and so forth. And when we got there, it was an absolute shambles. And what I think our duties were to prepare the camp for new intakes of service personnel as the war went on. The armament of the camp was one short Lee Enfield rifle and one revolver. And I always remember we had to prepare in case we were attacked by German paratroopers. And we thought this was hilarious. And they had to go down. We were all marched down to the hedgerows and we all had to cut a stick, a stout stick, and sharpen it to a point at one end. And then we were given this drill, how we were to attack these highly trained, highly well-armed paratroopers if they landed in the Wembury area. And we thought we looked like Robin Hood's men when we were coming back that day. I always remember it. We thought it was a farce. We were joined at Wembury by boys from the Edinburgh who'd also suffered casualties when they were bombed at Rosyth. And then later we were joined with boys from the Hood. The draft from the Hood, they had an awful lot to tell us that was very disquieting, which was never made public. And they told us, the boys who obviously worked in the gun houses on the Hood, that the state of the guns on the Hood were in a very, very bad shape. And we couldn't understand this, because to us at the time, the Hood epitomised everything that was great in naval ships. But the boys